Well, hello and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, Nicola Roy. I hope you're having a great week. Here at the Cultural Coven, we had some lovely news. The Cultural Coven is the Times newspaper podcast of the week, and we had such a brilliant write-up from David Pollock. It really is such a lovely thing to emerge from what's been a lockdown trial and survival project, really, for me as an actor. So thank you so much for tuning in and being here with us for season two. It really does mean the world to us. If you're enjoying the conversation, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review. As a newer podcast, this will really go a long way to help more people find us and join the coven and keep us growing week by week. Also, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and follow us on social media at Cultural Coven on Twitter and at Cultural Coven Pod on Instagram. Anyway, drum roll. This week we have another cracking guest for you. He's a Scottish broadcasting legend, a DJ, TV presenter, panto baddie, an actor currently appearing in BBC Scotland's River City. Yes, that's right. It is, of course, Edinburgh's finest, the brilliant Grant Stott. I grew up watching Grant on kids' TV programme Fully Booked or listening to him DJ on Fourth One, and I then crossed paths with him through the theatre or when he was doing the interviewing when I was a guest on BBC Scotland's radio programme The Afternoon Show. So I was rather delighted when Grant said he would come on and I would be doing the questioning. Here we talk about growing up in Edinburgh, his diverse career, his connection to Frank Sinatra, panto, and of course his friendship with the late great actor Andy Gray. Grant's currently appearing in Sleeping Beauty, the pantomime at Edinburgh King's Theatre. It is sure to be a hoot as always, so please do go and get your tickets. Also in Edinburgh, the Lyceum Theatre is joining forces with the brilliant Catherine Wheels Theatre Company to bring the magic of Christmas back in a new show called Christmas Dinner, directed by Jill Robertson, who is just wonderful. And I've also read the script, and it really is a lovely family show about a stage manager who, after a horrible year, thinks Christmas should be cancelled, but the theatre has other ideas. It opens this week, so do go and get your tickets. Now, that is quite enough talking from me. Enjoy the episode. The Cultural Coven is presented in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. Hi, Grant. Well, the tables have turned. Never did I think I'd see the day when I'd be asking Grant Stott the questions. I feel rather honoured and nervous and maybe a wee bit mischievous. Welcome and thank you for joining me in the Cultural Coven. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And I too am a wee bit nervous and feeling a wee bit mischievous. and delighted to be in such esteemed company. The likes of Liz Lockhead and Ian Rankin and Lindsay Smith have all tread this path before me. So I don't know if I can keep the standard that high, but I'm going to try my best.
They have tread the sugarly path. Now, Grant, you are many things. You are a DJ, broadcaster, personality, presenter, actor. But tell me, is there any better accolade than being the puss on the bus for Lothian Regional Transport?
Oh, Nicola, that, you know, when it comes to looking back on my career and listing the highlights and the pivotal moments, puss on the bus will definitely be up there. And it was a wonderful accidental kind of thing that happened. Literally, the guys at Lothian Buses were doing a sort of marketing campaign, and they wanted a face to sort of back up the rider card, and it was just to punt the season-long rider card. So they got in touch with me and said, look, we don't really know how this is going to work out, but do you want to come in and do some photographs, and then, you know, you'll plug it? And we worked out how we would do it, and it just grew. And then I captioned this puss on the bus thing that just grew, because I think it's at first sort of Alan Stewart used it on stage at Panto one year. I walked on and he turned, oh Christ, look who it is, it's the puss on the bus. And that got a roar. So that was in for as long as I was on the back of the bus. But it came at a point when both my kids were quite young, and it was quite terrifying for them, and quite embarrassing, particularly for my son. Some of the things that they made me do to get dressed up in, and the characters that they had me you know, I remember they had me dressing up as a wee schoolboy once, you know, for the junior rider card. And this, the idea was I was trying my hand at getting a junior rider card. I was clearly too old for that. I was dressed in the shorts and this, and just looked stupid. And they had me as a hippie once. They had me in a shower. And my dad's like, and Sam would come and he'd go, "Dad, what are you doing now? I'm trying to be cool with my pals at school." They just, you know, and he would get tagged in on his Facebook, "This is your dad."
I mean, at least you can say that it shows your versatility, Grant.
That's, well, I'm trying to explain that to a 12-year-old when he's mortified and embarrassed. It didn't go down well. But no, it was great. And to be honest, what that did for my profile, nothing else, was magnificent because, you know, basically I was getting thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of free advertising. And it was all kind of tied in with my radio show, some of the stuff that we did. So, I mean, it was an absolutely, it was a brilliant win-win situation because it was a great partnership. And it was one of the things I was very proud of is that, you know, I had an association. I used to write for the Evening News. I've got an affiliation with the King's Theatre, obviously, Radio 4th. And then Lothian Buses came along. And it was all these iconic Edinburgh brands. And I'd had a little hand in them at some point. And for an Edinburgh lad, that was thrilling. But yeah, getting on the bus was magic.
I've never, ever made the cut to the side of the bus. I quite fancy, you know, doing the voice of the bus. I think that would be quite good. Would you fancy doing that, Grant?
I would love to do that, to be the voice of the buses, given that the bus is a wee bit ragged and worn now.
Stop it.
Maybe the voice would do.
I mean, you'll definitely get a job there. I just always have this fantasy of voicing the number 16 route as the child in me and saying, "You have now arrived at Cock Hat."
I used to get a 16 into school. That was my bus, and it was either because we lived in Swan Spring Avenue, which is kind of the middle between two bus roads. At the top road we had the 11, or down at the bottom we would get the 16. But I could see the 16 through Ox Gangs, and I could see it arriving around the corner. So I would literally be standing with my cup of tea and my toast. "Right, that's the bus!" And then I would gnash from my Ruckinor bag to get my 16 to Gillespie's. So that was my route in the morning.
Of course, yeah, because I grew up in Colonsay Mains, just down the road from you, but we would run up the road to get the 16, so I'd belt it up there. But yeah, you went to James Gillespie's and I went to Fir Hill, and we both know that the most important question in Edinburgh is, what school did you go to?
Indeed.
And currently James Gillespie's is number one and Fir Hill is number three, but nobody likes a SWAT, do they?
No, nobody likes a SWAT. And for me, being at Gillespie's was brilliant because it was such an iconic school. And I'd been to Brunsfield Primary before then, and so that was just like across the meadows. I remember, let me get this right. Yeah, because the catchments used to be really strict. And if you weren't in the catchment, my mum had to fight on a couple of occasions so I could stay, because we originally moved up to Morton Hall near Fairmile Head when I was in primary school. And they went, "Oh, you're going to have to go to Liberton Primary." And I'm like, "I can't leave Brunsfield. All my pals are there." So we came to this agreement, right, with the school that I could stay at Brunsfield Primary, but as long as I was never late for school. So I had to get up early, make sure I was on the bus. And I, to this day, I don't know if that was just my mum and dad, you know, putting together a wee plot to make sure that I got my act together every morning. But that was the threat that hung over me. If you miss the bus, if you're late for school, then they're going to have to send you to Liberton.
That sounds to me like your mum and dad were at it. I don't know if I can see the school writing that in the contract. If he's late once, he's out.
He's been,
I was thinking back to when I first met you. I think it was probably about 10 years ago at a press night for a panto at the King's Theatre in Edinburgh. And then I've seen you various times over the years in professional occasions, being interviewed by you on the afternoon programme for the BBC, or just dotting about Edinburgh. And you sort of have this kind of Sean Connery thing going on. And I don't mean the sibilant S. You're synonymous with Edinburgh. And like the late Sir Sean, everyone has a story about how they know Grant Scott. Really do. How their auntie's neighbour's dog met you at Sainsbury's. And I imagine that's really lovely. But are you able just to go for lunch and be left alone?
Okay. My profile is such that it's by no means, you know, up there, or I think I'm on the right side of celebrity in so much that I'm not quite there yet. So I'm just sort of simmering under, you know. I've got because I do all these amazing, wonderful things, be on the radio or popping up on the telly and doing panto and stuff, and people, get to know your face. And especially in Edinburgh, because you're from Edinburgh and you still hang out in the same places in Edinburgh, and the reaction, touch wood, is always lovely. And that's a lovely thing when people come up and, you know, tell you they've got the tickets booked for the panto, or, you know, they heard you chatting on the radio to somebody, or you know, you're buying vinyl records for your show or whatever on Friday night, and they're picking up on that. So no, it's lovely. It may not be quite so warm and lovely in certain parts of town, like Tynecastle and Gorgas, you know. So I tend to watch when I visit these places, but no. But generally, it's lovely, and I'm very honoured to get that kind of recognition.
You were in the Police, mm-hmm. and was that the original plan then? Because I heard you also had auditioned for drama school.
The Police was never the original plan. The plan all through school was genuinely to go to drama college. Right from an early age, I can't remember not being passionate about getting on the stage, doing drama, reading plays and things. All through primary school, whenever there was a school show or a drama production, I was in it. And same in high school, the first club I joined in first year, when you go around and you're on the tables and see what clubs are, I looked for the drama club, member of the drama club all the way through school. And this was like the 80s, so there wasn't a lot of, you know, on the syllable for the syllabus. Check me in my good English. There wasn't much on the syllable for drama. At Gillespie's, there wasn't an O-grade drama. So we had to use the O-level drama, which was the English equivalent, because they didn't have one in Scotland. So I ended up sitting that, got that. And then I was told by the careers advisor, because they says, what do you want to do when you leave school? I says, I want to be an actor, I want to go to drama college. What do I need? And they says, well, you need 4 O-grades and 2 hires to get into drama college. So that was my goal. So I spent the next 3 or 4 years getting 4 O-grades and 2 hires. That was it. That was as soon as I achieved that, I got that in fifth year. So then I went, right, I could just enjoy sixth year then. I don't have to bother about getting anything else, because all I need to get into drama college to do what I want to do is the qualifications that I had. So then sixth year comes and goes, have a brilliant time in sixth year. You leave school, you wave cheerio at your pals and say, right, that's it, I'm away to drama college. I'll let you know which one I choose. And I'll tell you where I'm going to end up. And then I applied for all the drama colleges. And this is where the flaw in my plan raised its head, in so much that I clearly hadn't prepared well enough, and I didn't get into any one of them. I tried Glasgow, tried London, tried Queen Margaret here in Edinburgh, and I remember thinking, because I'd convinced myself I was going to go to London or I was going to go to Glasgow, and then it was okay. Well, you know, if I stay in Edinburgh too, I'll just go to Queen Margaret. I'll just go to Queen Margaret. So that gives you an idea of the size of my head, you know, because. You know, just because I'd been very fortunate with the roles that I got in school.
Yes.
And I think if you're the guy who gets these roles, or if you're the person that gets these roles in school, what you don't, or what you weren't, what I wasn't prepared for, was going into an audition room where there was another 20 of these guys from their schools who'd all done the same as you. And clearly there was an awful lot of better contenders. So I got a short, sharp shock very early on in my desire to be an actor, and it all fell flat. So that's why the Police came up.
Okay, but that's not uncommon, actually, is it? Because, I mean, I took 2 years to get in,
yeah.
And it's something crazy, like a lot of drama schools get 3,000 applications for 28 places, and often the reason you don't get in is not lack of talent, it's maybe they've got someone like you in that year group already, or there's just so many different factors, or you think you need a bit of maturity. I was very much like, of course I'll be going straight from school, straight to drama school. And you're right, if you've been the person in the plays at school, getting the leads, you don't really comprehend that there's other people like you out there.
And it's not until you get to go, oh, hang on a minute, you're very good. Oh, you're good. Oh, you're excellent. God, that was part of it. And it was a sort of life lesson, if you like, very early on. And at that point, you know, and again, you know, just by youth or you know, because everybody knocked me back, there wasn't this understanding and sense of understanding that you just touched on there, that sometimes it does take you 2 or 3 attempts. Yes. People rarely get in on their first attempt. Especially the conservatoire and things like that now. But so I didn't know that back then. So my assumption was, I've not got into drama college, so I can't now be an actor. That's it, my dream is over. What am I going to do in my life now? How's this going to pan out? Because I don't know anything else that I want to do. There's nothing else on my mind.
It's tough, isn't it? Mm. It's really, and it's something that we have to continually deal with in the business. So I suppose in some ways it's good training, but it doesn't make it any less brutal. So, you were in the Police. Were you a Bobby on the beat then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, it's ridiculous. This big idiot. I mean, how scary would I be if you were some bam running right up and down the street and then I come towards you?
You're so lovely. I can't imagine you arresting anybody or just on you go, pal, be all right.
That's, Nicola, that's exactly what I was, right? I was a rubbish policeman, right? I was rubbish. I mean, I did, you know, my head was in the space and I got through probation. They originally sent me down to Jedburgh, down the borders, which was a real sort of shock to the system as well, because he was me, a city boy, lived and breathed Edinburgh all my life. I'd been DJing in nightclubs, the amphitheatre and coasters and Outer Limits and things. And then I end up getting sent to Jedburgh. And I'm like, I've got to look up on a map where this place is. No idea where it was. So I'm set down there. But again, it was good for me to do that, to get that sort of life experience of, one, it was the first time I'd lived away, I'd lived anywhere apart from home, looking after myself. Had to get my driving license because I couldn't drive. So then, I was relying on lifts or a bus to get back up. And it was a different, the 16 didn't go down to Jedburgh from my mum and dad's house. So yeah, so that was a great life experience. Eventually gets up to Gayfield Square, and I did Princess Street, I did the whole thing, George Street and right uptown. So it was two sides of the police, and it just reminded me I'm not very good at this.
So what actually made you leave the police then?
I got one of those life-changing phone calls from a pal of mine, Donnie Hughes, who I used to DJ with in Coasters and Outer Limits, and so he was a pal, and he was on air, he was at Radio 4th at that time. And he got in touch with me around about 1989 and said to me, he says, big fella, he says, if you're still interested in radio, because I was, I'd been doing demos and things at that point, but because I'd done Top Man in Princess Street. That was my first sort of taste of radio. I'd done in-store radio for Top Man. And I thought, I quite like this radio idea. Instead of DJing in the clubs, it's a much more intimate and a nice sort of connection with the audience. So I started working on, doing demo tapes and stuff like that. So anyway, so he phones me up and says, Radio 4 is going to split into two frequencies. It's going to go FM, it's going to go AM. All the radio stations in the country are doing this. And Radio 4, RFM as it was going to launch. And that's going to be the cool, young, trendy radio station playing all the sort of young team hits. And then there's Max AM on medium wave that's going to play all the oldies. So I put a demo in and the boss says, nah, he says, I've got plenty young presenters. He says, I'm actually looking for presenters for Max AM, for the older station. I went, oh no. I says, listen, I can play Frank Sinatra. I can play the Beatles. I can play Shirley Bassey. Just let me go away and do another demo tape. So I went away, right. Did another demo tape, playing some easy listening and classic, Sinatra and things. I mean, there he is there, got all blue eyes here behind me. and that got me in. That was my choice to take this opportunity.
Yeah.
To go and do two shifts a week for £40 a shift. It was 2 in the morning till 6 in the morning, 1 in the morning till 6 in the morning, a Saturday and a Sunday. And I'm like, right, wow. I need to take this chance. And so I did the overnight slot at the weekend.
Or one of your programmes, I don't know if it was your original one, on after Andy, the minister.
I was basically on straight after Andy. So I would go into Radio 4th, sort of midnight, 12:30 or whatever, start looking out my records and my tunes and making my notes and figuring out my quizzes and all that. Meanwhile, all I'm hearing, hello, it's Andy here. You're in tune with the Open Line on Radio 4th. If you have a problem in your life, then phone me and we can discuss it. And that's what that show was. And people were very cruel and they phoned up Andy and wound him up. Was that you, Nicola? Were you? Did you sometimes phone up a bit?
It was not me, but I do have a bit of an Andy story, which is, she shall remain nameless, but I had an auntie who rather liked her wee 5 minutes of fame, mm-hmm. and of a weekend at times would call in to Andy. And my cousins and I, when we were together, were sometimes allowed to stay up and listen in, and we would be in fits of giggles. It was awful, but the things that she would phone in about.
He got quite cute with sussing when people were on the wind-up or whatever. But when I did my one-man show, I did a one-man show at The Fringe a few years ago, Tales from Behind the Mic, and I did this piece on the fact that I followed Father Andy. And because it was such an intrinsically Edinburgh audience, I would say, and some people would phone up Father Andy and take the piss, and you just saw these faces and people would skulk back into their seats. So many people were a wee bit naughty and a bit rude to Father Andy back in the day. It was one of these institutions that everybody listened to.
Poor Father Andy. So you, as you were talking about, you didn't go to drama school, which is not uncommon. But do you feel like you've missed out in any way by not going to drama school, or actually do you feel like you gained a lot from a different path?
Well, it's difficult because I didn't go to drama school, so I don't really know what I've missed. But I know that I have learnt by doing
right.
it. And that goes as far back as my first panto, which was in 1993. And clearly I was awful in it.
I'm sure you weren't.
I was determined to get better. And so I'm like a little Hoover. I just watch and learn. And that's what I did. Because fortunately, with my first panto, being at the King's in Glasgow and then working in the King's in Edinburgh and then back in Glasgow again, I got to work with so many great people. From Alan Stewart on my first show, and Jimmy Chisholm was on my first show. The brilliant Sandy Morton, to me, he was King Rap. And I remember sitting at the read-through, and he just started and launched into this, his opening monologue. And I was just like agog. And that, I think that was the moment where I kind of went, that's what I want to do. I want to be the baddie. I want to be the villain. I want to be that guy that's on stage that terrifies the Waynes. But then I would watch everybody else. I watched Gerard Kelly closely. I worked with him, Elaine C. Smith, Barbara Rafferty, working with Alan. Then, of course, latterly with Andy. Latterly, 20 years. And I just watched all these people. I watched Cannon and Ball. I did 2 years with Cannon and Ball. Completely different to the other names that I've just mentioned, but they could control an audience. They would... You know, they would do the same routines, but I would watch these same routines night after night after night, because there would just be something sometimes that would happen that would turn it on its head. And Bobby Ball in particular was just a brilliant man to watch. But yeah, so that's how I was fortunate. So I started, I would watch and learn. I wasn't one of these sort of, you know, radio TV people who would get a gig in panto and just stroll on, learn the lines and walk through it. I was determined to be his best, to be the best that I could be. And that was the same every year. And it still is. It still is the same. I still work really hard at trying to, you know, with regards to the villain in Edinburgh, I work really hard at doing something different every year with that villain.
You're right. Some people who have been, say, personalities on the radio might just walk on and be themselves. But what I always notice when I watch you is you completely transform yourself. You are an actor.
I can't
when
get used to
that. I think we all feel like that, you know, even though I went to drama school, I feel a fraud every day. I did my first panto with Gerard Kelly. It was at the Glasgow Kings, and it was actually my first ever stage job. And I really appreciated for the first time how much craft is required in these pieces and the dedication of the actors. And I remember Gerard Kelly saying to me, it doesn't matter if it's a 10 a.m. show, you give it the same welly as you would as an evening show. You give the same show. And that's always stuck with me.
There's a thing I think about the Scottish performers that I named who are absolutely deadly serious about this craft and about what panto is and what it means. And Kelly is absolutely right when he says, you know, you treat it as a 10 o'clock show or a 6 o'clock show, it doesn't matter. And the whole aspect of going off, you just don't do it.
You just don't.
And we would sit in the dressing room and the company manager would come in just to say, we've lost so-and-so, the dancer's not on and such can't make it either. They've got a sore throat. I'm sorry, what? They can't go. It's just unheard of. I did Glasgow with Kelly. He was in hospital. He ended up going to hospital with pneumonia, and he would still go on the next day. I ended up doing the song sheet for him because by that point he was done. So that was a great thrill. Kelly came to me and said, could you do the song sheet? And I'm like, oh my God. And then he got better. And then I said to him at the end, I said, so are you fit enough now to do the song sheet? He goes, no, pal. He says, you made it your own. You can just have it for the rest of the run. And I'm like, oh God, that's amazing. You know, because I obviously was in my absolute element learning this and learning how to work the crowd and do the song sheet and everything like that. So he was very particular like that. And I have a little tradition that I do with the babes backstage. And it's funny because they join in on it. And it's like a little thing. I do this. And it's usually our second show in, right? And there's a reason for it. So, you know, you're walking there, you get your beginners, and you're going for your dressing room, and because I'm the baddie, I'm usually the first on.
Yeah.
So we always have a group hug, Alan, Andy, and I, three of us. Oh. We would do that. And then I would make my way to the stage. And waiting to go onto the stage, lined up, would be the babes, right, who inevitably were going to be on the opening number. And I would always stop and go, remember, it's not your first show. It's their first show. Take that with you. And then I would go and walk on, right? So I did that. I do that on the second show, and because obviously the first show is their first show, and it doesn't make sense.
Yes.
So, and then that becomes part of my routine because I've done that on the way in. I need to do that. And so they're all desperate to, whenever they see me coming down the stairs, they're always desperate to try and preempt me. And they all do it as like a big course. It's not your first show. It's their first show. Take that with you. And so this runs for the entire run of the panto. But as much as a bit of a laugh, it's a bit of a joke. I'm deadly serious about that because it really is. And what brings me back to that was one afternoon matinee, God, it's early 2000s. I think we were doing Goldilocks and Three Bears. I was the villain. Heinkel, I think his name was. Lovely Joe Freer was my wife. And I had plotted that the way I was going to get my revenge was I was going to kidnap Baby Bear, right? And we had this little cute little Baby Bear costume, right? All the kids fell in love with Baby Bear. Of course you do. And so I'm at the downstage left, and I say, I've got an idea. I'm going to poison Baby Bear. And I brings out this bottle of poison from inside my jacket. And I remember there was about three rows from the front. There was this little girl who was probably ages with my own daughter, Laurie, at the time. Yeah, about four, something like that. And she was kind of two or three seats in, and she grabbed the seat in front of her and jumped up. And she shouted at me. She goes, no, no, you will not poison Baby Bear. The veins were sticking out of her neck. If she could have got anywhere near me, she would have torn me apart. That's what it's all about.
The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. So, Grant, you worked a lot with your late great friend, the wonderful actor Andy Gray, and I imagine you'll be feeling that loss more than most this year because you're doing panto without him. He was a much-loved star in Scotland, and it was horribly sad what happened. But his daughter, Claire, is going to be joining you on stage this year at the King's, isn't she? And I think that is a really beautiful tribute.
Yeah, it's. I mean, Claire's kind of part of the family anyway, but because she's been with us twice before. She was one of the uglies in Cinderella, and then she was Mummy Bear when we did Goldilocks with Andy. And it's lovely that we've got Claire. And I spoke to Claire about doing it earlier this year, and because it's obviously a massive undertaking. I mean, Claire lives in Glasgow for a start, so she has a small daughter, lovely Anna, and so as an undertaking for her to get to Edinburgh to do a show and do a run is massive, and all the complications domestically that brings. Added into this, the emotional aspect of what of this show is going to be like now. It was a massive ask, so we gave her plenty of time. You know, listen, just stew over the decision, have a think about it, see what you want to do. And then I spoke to her a few weeks later, and she was saying, you know, because I was thinking about it, I didn't know if I was able to be able to do it. And then she goes, I just suddenly saw my dad's face going, sorry, you're thinking about not doing panto at the King's Theatre, net? What? What? So, yeah, and she instantly in that moment thought, God, he would never have allowed that. He would never have, because that was the one thing about Andy is, you know, he was... He didn't like people wallowing in, you know, sad situations like this. You know, if a celebrity died, one of his pet hates was people going on Twitter, oh my God, I can't believe this man has died. He was one of my favourite actors of all time. I met him once on a tube in London and he got off at the next stop. But I'm so sad, you know, and all these kind of things. He hated all that kind of thing. So he would not like, you know, people, you know, especially his own daughter, sort of going, oh no, I can't do the show because it just upset me too much. He would go, get on that stage.
So
actually Alan, Jordan and myself, Ed, who's our writer and director, and Michael, our producer, we're delighted, obviously, to have Claire, delighted that we have Grey, the name, on the show, but yes. for ourselves, because it's going to be hard. There's going to be so many speed bumps over that entire run from day one in rehearsals to first show to middle of the run to the pante, all these things that we always did with Andy, to now not have him there as part of it. We're going to need each other. We're going to all need each other, and we're going to take his legacy and go forward with it, and we're going to make it very special, and we'll have a moment for Andy at some point in the show and do it. It just made that whole tricky situation quite lovely, actually. So yeah, we're obviously very much looking forward to it. Can't wait to get back on the stage, but it's going to be hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. And but you're right, Claire is an actress in her own right, so it's wonderful to have her there, but it's also nice, I imagine, to have that link to Andy. But I'm sure Jordan Young will be there, you know, pulling some stunts and keeping you all laughing.
We have the best time, and that's very much part of what we've always tried to do. You know, people have come and gone on the show as part of the company, part of the cast, and, you know, one thing that we have always tried to instill, because they say, you know, shows work from the top, and, you know, when you have Alan and Andy, you know, at the front of the show, then their sense of fun, especially Andy's, always worked its way right the way throughout the cast.
You feel the warmth of all of you. I think you can tell there's a genuine bond when we were watching you guys on stage. And it must be the dream to be at the King's in Edinburgh, because that's in very close vicinity to where you grew up. Were you aware of the theatres around you when you were growing up?
Yeah, my lovely Nana, my granny, took me to the King's. It was the first theatre I can recall going to, was the King's Theatre. And I can barely remember the show, but I think Peter Morrison was in it singing on a bridge upstage at some point. So it was like, must have been some sort of variety show or something like that.
Right.
And I can remember where we were sitting in the circle. So my granny took me, and I lost her when I was only about 8 or something. For that reason, it's a special building.
Oh, I can imagine. Childhood memories of going to a particular theatre with family always make being on stage there that bit more special. Now, I don't know about you, Grant, but I quickly found you need a sense of humour in this business, or if you don't, I would fear for you. There is so much opportunity for things to go wrong. And I learned very quickly that if they do, it's very likely your cheeky castmates might take the mickey out of you. Has anything ever happened to you like that before, Grant?
Oh, God, how long have we got? Is this the first part in a series of installments? As that famous film once said, we're going to need a bigger podcast. There have been so many things. And I think one that stands out, one that kind of, you know, sort of resonates even more now, of course, involves the lovely Andy Gray. And it was Jack and the Beanstalk. And I had this front cloth scene with Andy, and he was, you know, the usual idiot character in the show. And basically, I came on as Flesh Creep. And I came on him, and I would be very cross and very angry. I would say, right, I'm going to take over, you know, I'm going to get the beans, and I'm going to do this, or whatever it was I was going to do. And Andy, within a few days, when I'm at full pelt going, don't you be so cheeky to me, I will have you, and I will punish you, and I will do all this. And he just stopped. He goes, for goodness sake, don't shout. Just act. Right? And of course, that immediately, poof, right, that gets me, but the audience absolutely loved it. And he was going, honestly, he says, you just come on and shout at me all the time, and you're spitting, just act, right? And of course, he would just then go on, of course, I can't talk that. I cannot come back on that. And obviously, the audience won't let the villain ever get the better of the wonderful Andy Gray.
Yes.
So that night, I'm hatching a plan. So he does this because he realises it gets a great reaction from the audience. So he decides to keep this in. So this stays in, this line.
Yeah.
Don't shout. Just act. So I'm thinking, right, I'm going to get you back. So I got a copy of "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," the whole poem. And I learnt that religiously. And I had this plan in my head that at that scene, that point, and he says, don't shout, just act. I'm going to step forward into the spotlight, and I'm going to perform to the best of my ability. So I've got it learnt. I'm learning it at night. I'm between shows, pacing up and down in my dressing room. It was the night before Christmas, always alone, another mouse, the whole thing. Back to front, up and down, in the car, I'm away. I'm ready to go. Christmas Eve, I'm going to get them on Christmas Eve. So it's Christmas Eve, it's our second show. It's night time, it's right in the middle of the first half. And we walks on, and true to form, Andy delivers the line, "Don't shout, just act." Huge roar from the crowd. So at that point, I get a collar. And I was wearing sunglasses at the time, Matrix thing. So I takes the glasses off, folds them up, puts them in the inside of my pocket, step forward in the spotlight. 'Twas the night before Christmas.
I'm dying for you.
My brain just froze, right? And I'll never forget, because as I stepped forward, Andy obviously realised I was going to be doing something. So Andy, being his wonderful, generous self, stepped back. He went, "Oh." So he stepped back. And as I did it, and then when
gave
I dried,
the space.
Gave me the space. And then, so I dried. And I'm still like that. And then I just felt him peering around going, "Are you quite finished? Is that it?" Right? And I was like, I'd planned to do a big thing about the poem tonight before Christmas. It was just rubbish. And I forgot. So, of course, and I just created this wonderful open target for him. And he got the...
That is an absolute belter. I mean, I applaud you, you know, your dedication.
That was a very short, sharp lesson that I got from Andy. That night. And it just stuck with me ever since. And thinking back, it does highlight all those traits of Andy, his generosity and his brilliance.
So, Grant, you're well known for singing an alternative version of That's Life called That's Fife, which is absolute comic gold. Tell me, is that a lived experience of the Kingdom of Fife, or did you have a Fife-based co-writer?
No, it's a wonderful story, the whole Fife thing. It came about because we were doing the Radio 4th Awards, and every year at the awards, I would always try and do a wee skit again, you know, use that stage time to try and have a bit of fun. I would never recite "Twas the Night Before Christmas," but I would always try and do something imaginative, something funny, a wee skit, a song, a sketch or something. And this one year, because 4th won, we were always, we're here live across Edinburgh, the Lothians and Fife. So I thought, I wonder if I could get a song, if I could do a funny wee song that sort of has Edinburgh, the Lothians and Fife as its strapline, as its sort of hook. So I tried this night. I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning trying to find a song to parody that could use that phrasing, because I thought that would work really well. Nothing was working. The closest I could get was "You're Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile," because it was Edinburgh, the Lothians and Fife. That's all I had. I had nothing else before it, nothing else after it. That's right. All I had, but I couldn't make it work. So anyway, so I'm on the phone. I'm driving to work the next morning, tired, because I've been up till 2:30 in the morning. And my mate Mino phones me, who I went to school with, beautiful guy, and always very funny. And I've always sort of taken bits of humour off him over our lifetime. And I said, "Yeah, I can't get Edinburgh, the Lothians and Fife to scan at all. I can't get it to work." He goes, "Just keep it simple." He says, "Get Frank Sinatra's That's Life and make it That's Fife." I was like, ding, you know, the big light bulb goes off over my head. So gets into work, does my show that day, straight back home, sits down in front of my computer. I get the words to "That's Life" by Frank Sinatra on one side of the screen. I've got the Google Maps of Fife on the other side. And then, so I just start looking for bits that I can replace things. And the obvious bit was, you know, being a puppet, a popper, a pirate, a poet, you know. So I thought, right, well, we're going to do a wee tour of Fife. So I've been to Dunfermline, Glenrothes, Crosskeys, Byhaven, Cowden, Meath too. So that works. Okay, so that goes. So then we just built this whole thing. And then put it together for the awards. Mino came in and helped me create a PowerPoint. So Mino was backstage pressing the space bar on his laptop to make all the slides move on to the next bit. So we got all these funny pictures of Fife and all that. And that's what ended up on YouTube the next day. And then it just went nuts.
It's wild. It's wild. So many people have seen it. And I saw a clip of you performing it at the Usher Hall. And
that's where we did it. That was at the Usher Hall. That was where we were doing the awards. And so that was the first time. And I felt like a pop star.
You looked like one. You were rocking that stage.
And then it became Save Lives when the pandemic struck. Yes, during the pandemic. I'm just trying to see if it's here, actually, because I printed it off. Yeah, here we are. I was sitting in my... just getting out of my bed, checking my emails one Sunday morning, and I got an email sent to me from my agent.
Right.
And it was from a gentleman called Dean Kay from Demi Music Corporation, Burbank, California. And he said, "Hello, wanted to let Grant know how much I enjoyed Save Lives and That's Fife. Hope you can forward this email to him. Both recordings are very well done, but I've gotten a lot of particularly positive reactions to Save Lives from friends." This is the guy that wrote That's Life for Frank Sinatra.
No way.
Yeah. He wrote That's Life. And he sent me this email to say how much he enjoyed it. And particularly the arrangement that we did for that, for Save Lives, which we changed. We put in a little piano tinkling, which he picks up on, because he says, "I'd love to know where he got the track. This intro is very reminiscent of Sinatra's One for My Baby, One for the Road. I might use it when I perform the song with the original lyrics, of course." So, and that came from Andy Pickering, who's our MD at the Panto. And I said to him, I says, "I want to start it with a sort of speakeasy kind of piano feel." And he's, and it was very much inspired by the One for My Baby, One for the Road by Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And so, and he tagged it on to my Back in Bed for That's Fife. To have the guy who wrote it, I thought he was sending me a cease and desist order. I thought he was going to sue me. I thought he was going to close me down. But no, he was a fan. He loved it.
Wow, that is something really to be proud of. That's incredible, Grant. Such high praise. Oh, my goodness. And obviously, your version in the pandemic raised awareness too, which is brilliant. And something I've noticed more and more is that Scottish artists have a long history of being politically and socially engaged and proactive. But for me, you are probably one of the most socially proactive people I know. You're an ambassador for so many charities, which is so admirable. Have you always had that social conscience, Grant, or did it come to you later, or is it something you feel is part of your job?
I think it's part of your job. You know, if you can do something, and I think I remember that one of the very first charity events, if you want to call it that, was for the sick kids, and it was like that was a no-brainer because, you know, you grew up in Edinburgh. At some point in your life, you are going to have some experience of how fabulous the sick kids are, be it for yourself or someone in your family or your own kids. So that was probably one of the earliest associations, and I'm still associated with the sick kids. That was, you know, that's like nearly 30 years now that I've been doing things for them, and I've always felt, you know, and I've always taken on charitable events, and I, you know, I cherry pick them, and It's Good to Give is another one that I'm big with, but it's just what you do, isn't it? It's just, you know, it's and this is how I do it. You know, people have different ways of giving back, and I've been, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've got a lovely career, a lovely life, and if I can help out, then who wouldn't? I assume that's what we all do.
I think a lot of people do, but you definitely, I think, do more than most, and I think it's lovely. So I'm going to move on to our creative challenge now, right, okay. If you're ready.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about how synonymous you are with Edinburgh, and many well-known artists of the past have penned their love for Edinburgh's culture and beauty. One being William McGonagall, who's widely regarded as one of the worst poets in English literature. He wrote several odes to Edinburgh, one being "Beautiful city of Edinburgh, most wonderful to be seen, with your ancient palace of Holyrood and Queen's Park Green, and your big, magnificent, elegant new college, where people from all nations can be taught knowledge." I mean,
that's,
it's not wrong,
joyous.
But you have done your bit, definitely done your bit on selling parts of Edinburgh. In the 1990s, you were the face of Cameron Toll Shopping Centre TV advert.
Yes, I was a media tart, Nicola. That's clearly what I was. I was a media tart. That's all.
And it is obviously an Edinburgh institution. The advert was a jazzy affair with some background graphics, and you strolled through that shopping centre, punting it to us with the words, and I quote, "Have you been to Cameron Toll lately? Everything's under one roof. There's so many shops. I'm sold, Grant."
I'm just going to have to pick you up a wee bit there, Nicola, because it was actually, "Have you been to Cameron Toll lately?" That's kind of how it was.
I was being a little bit unkind there. I do apologise. But I mean, you had me sold. And for me, you really destroyed that all fur coat and knee knickers image of Edinburgh. So you have sold us Fife before. Let's imagine that Visit Scotland need a new Edinburgh ad. Please, can you sell us the real Edinburgh in a few sentences?
I love a wee rhyme. I love a wee rhyme. Right. A wee pat. So I'm going to take a wee bit of inspiration from Mr. McGonagall there and try and just writing a couple of things down here. Visit Edinburgh, our city's just capital. It said so on a badge. I wore one once to Goldberg's when I was just a teeny tiny wee raj. That's a nice wee starter. What about, visit Edinburgh, a top-notch city, or Glasgow, our hand is the one that's upper. Proof, if required, is all down to one thing. Who puts what upon their fish supper?
That's a beauty.
I've just got another wee one here. Let's see how this goes. Visit Edinburgh. It's got all that you would wish. Culture, history, and football. But go see Hibs, because hearts are... And I can't quite finish that off. I just can't get a, I just can't get a line to finish that. I don't know why.
That's funny that 50% of our audience have just dipped out. I think it worked brilliant, Dan. Thank you. You absolutely took that challenge, embraced it, and won. I particularly liked version one, I think.
You like version
one?
That
might be my favourite. Yeah, okay. I love some classic Edinburgh words like Raj. So your daughter, Laurie, is also an actor. How did you feel about your daughter going into the industry?
Well, it's interesting because Laurie... This is not a pushy parent scenario here by any stretch of the imagination. She has absolutely, everything that she has done and achieved, she's absolutely done it on her own and done it on her own back. And I can testify that because she actually got into drama college. I remember watching her and her preparation for her auditions and how she checked the different universities and what the courses were. And I'm like, I never put that amount of work into what I did when I tried to get into drama college. I never worked that hard. So what's good about this course that she's done, it's writing, performing and directing. So she's getting a little bit of everything all in. Mm-hmm. So, and then she can decide what path she wants to go down because, you need to multitask and do lots of different things as opposed to just, oh, this is all I can do.
Oh my goodness, yeah, absolutely. That's kind of why I'm doing this. Got to do something.
This is a good example with this podcast because, you know, when lockdown hit you and you know, stopped your work, your livelihood, everything else, you kind of have to go, well, what am I going to do and how am I going to still get that creative buzz?
Yes.
And that's what I think, that's one of the positives that I think lockdown has done. It's challenged a lot of people. And to see what people have done and how they have used that time and opportunity to do something creative in ways that they would never have thought about otherwise is brilliant. Are you enjoying the podcasting?
I am, yeah. I really am enjoying it. The first series was pretty much a trial, really, but it went down really well and had just really grateful to people who took a leap of faith and came and chatted to me. Yeah. I'm very grateful to yourself. But I think... It's a positive to take away from this lockdown, and it's something that I really enjoy and would quite like to kind of get into more as an area. But you worked on Outlander, didn't you, Grant?
Yes, I did. And that's one of these strange, again, amazing little things that kind of come up and actually end up happening. I was taken on by Susie at Infinity Artists as an agent. And I've had a couple of experiences with agents in the past. I think for me, what works with an agent in this sense is that, you know, she had to have an understanding of who I am and what I am, because I don't really know that myself sometimes. It's like, so if you then, because I've got so much baggage of doing all these other things, are you going to be looked at as an actor? Is anyone going to give you an opportunity? So I end up, I'm on set in Cumbernauld. Most of my scenes were shot in a green screen studio on the boat, the Sally Ann. And I'm taking Sam Hughan and Katrina Balfe down to meet Aunt Jocasta at the start of season four. And I can just remember, right, because I'd done High Road years ago, right? And I remember walking on High Road just like, what happens here? And I was just completely shell-shocked by the whole experience. I didn't know what I was doing. So I thought, right, I'm walking on this set. I've got to look like I know what I'm doing here. This happens to me every week. I'm just going to, yeah. So I walks in, yeah, you want me to stand here? Okay, yeah, cool, yeah, yeah. I'm like, I've got no idea what I'm doing. I'm just waiting for them to do my lines. And I was just so terrified that I just wanted to learn my lines. I just had to make sure that my lines were out.
Yeah.
So I look at it now and I'm like, oh God, stop it. It's woeful because I'm just basically, it's like I've got the fear in my eyes.
Experience. I watched it. I don't agree, but it is, oh. I mean, it's a very quick turnaround when you're filming, and I always think it takes a while to warm up as well. Yeah. Like, you know, if I've not filmed for a while, and you've got all these people around you. It's a crazy environment.
It was a great experience, and Sam Hewen was utterly lovely. I know he's been in the podcast with you as well.
Yeah.
And it was funny because we're having a break, and Sam was standing, we're chatting. I'm going, so how's it been? I mean, because like, here's Sam and Katrina, right? It's their show, and they've got people like me coming in all the time, right? They've got to be nice to these new faces all the time. You're dead keen, dead excited, and desperate to, you know, do well in the show. So he's got to be nice to these people constantly, right? And that's part, but as it happens, they're both lovely, so it was fine. And we're just standing, there was a wee silence, and we're standing in the boat waiting for whatever it was to be set. And he went, did you once do a children's TV program in the 90s with a Highland cow? And I was like, actually, yes, I did. He goes, I knew it was you.
Oh, you can always count on Sam just to kind of make you feel relaxed. He's got a wee cheeky kind of side to him.
And at that point, I just went, oh, this is nice. This is lovely. So Outlander is available now on DVD and Blu-ray, season 4, episodes 1 and a wee bit of the beginning of episode 2.
There you are. And did you get a lot of American fans following you from that? Because when I did my interview with Sam, they were wonderful. They're lovely. I've been invited to America and everything. I mean, they are dedicated.
Yeah, I think that was part of what shared Save Lives, because I think a couple of Outlander people started sharing that as well. The fans are incredible. And Sam had kind of spoke to me about that.
So you're probably the person with the most knowledge of what is going on in the Scottish arts and culture. Because
I don't know. I think you'll find Janice Forsyth. Maybe
it's between you and Janice, because you speak to so many people on the afternoon show on BBC Radio. What for you is kind of hot in Scottish arts and culture at the moment? What are you most excited by?
I'm excited about the doors are opening again with regards to what you talk about the art scene. And it kind of harks back to what we talked about how you expanded into the world of podcasting, is how, you know, what we've done over the last year and a half, what elements of that will be ditched and what elements of that will become part of the new norm. And I think, you know, an example would be what the Book Festival are doing, for example. They're putting some live events, some author events back on this year, which is obviously great. But because their online activity was so well received, and they garnered this whole new audience from across the globe, they're going to adapt that as well, and that will build. So I think we're going to see a sort of change in the landscape and a shift in the landscape. We're also going to see the outdoor aspect. You know, here I'm going to see a show this afternoon at the car park at Castle Terrace, and I think that's been such a hit and what the Edinburgh Festival have done in the quadrangle at the university and out at Riccarton. This has been, it's been so positive. It's like, you know, this wonderful, spacious outdoor pavilions, which even if it starts to rain, you can still sit and enjoy the show. So I think that element will remain. I think, you know, the car park is such a genius use of that. You know, it's an eyesore, really, normally, but then to turn it into this wonderful venue where they can put on comedy, they're putting on theatre, and you've got the castle as your backdrop. That's fabulous. So it's like, you would never have done this. We would never have thought about it. So, you know, these things are exciting.
I agree. I think there is, hopefully some things will change. And actually, I'm all for anything that makes theatre more accessible. So if that means that some things are online as well, then I think we can have both, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were at Forth One for 27 years, I think.
Yeah.
And then you moved over to BBC Radio.
Yeah.
And now you find yourself in River City. So, you know, that's quite a few transitions there. How are you finding River City?
I am loving it. It has been every bit as wonderful as I hoped it would be. And to go, you know, to the chat that we had earlier on about, you know, 16, 17-year-old Grant expecting to waltz off into drama college and, you know, never be the same again, it's taken me a bit of time. It's taken a while.
But so, you got there, so, and that's got there, what matters.
And it is that kind of thing. And that's what I think is making it even more special than if it happened 20, 25 years ago. The fact that it has happened now, I'm 54 years of age, I've, you know, and I feel that I've worked so hard at it, and that, not just doing the panto, but doing all the shows at the Fringe that I did with Andy, and that's kind of all, it's all intrinsically linked, because, you know, it got to the point where I wanted to do a play, I wanted to test myself, I wanted to see if I could actually do a straight play, and it was Andy that went, I'll do a play with you, and that's when we started doing the Fringe, and I learned, you know, it was like a masterclass with Andy, every rehearsal, every show, every post-show debrief or whatever, we would, you know, I would just listen to him and watch and learn, and, you know, we did all the different plays that we did. I've really worked hard at it, and then for this to come, and it's all kind of linked into losing Andy and the timing of it all, but then when Martin McCarty got in touch and said, look, there's a role, how'd you fancy joining the show? It was like that moment in Jaws when Roy Scheider's sitting on the beach, and then Spielberg came up with that moment where he just kind of zooms in and the whole background pans out. It's like, and I was sitting right here in this room having that Zoom conversation with Martin. And of course, I'm trying to be cool and going, would I like to join the River City? Let me think. Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, that'd be cool. You know. So then to finally get on set, which we did over in June and July before they broke for the summer, was just lovely, and everybody's been fantastic. And again, I'm like watching everything like a hawk. I'm watching, learning, and can I do that better? And, you know, I'm quite sure I'll be watching my first episode through my fingers. But I'm just, you know, I'm determined for however long this wonderful experience lasts, I'm determined to be better by the end of it than I was at the start.
I think you'll be a brilliant asset to River City. Tell me about your character. What can you tell me about your character?
I had to check before I came on to chat to you what I was allowed to say. It's not been announced, so I can't.
Okay.
I can't preempt or say. I'm desperate to tell you, because
but don't, it's don't worry.
Fun. I can't let anything out of the bag at the moment. But I think my first episode's on screen in October. So,
okay.
Yeah, if you start watching now, you may get little clues as to what's going to happen.
Okay, let's not get you sacked before you even on screen.
No, don't get me killed off when I've just arrived. You know, that's the thing.
You know, you've spoken to so many wonderful people. Who has been your favourite Grant over the years?
I've got to throw in Billy Connolly.
I adore him.
Oh, literally, he was my last face-to-face guest before lockdown. It was the Thursday before lockdown, and we got a chance to interview him at an art gallery in Glasgow. He was there to promote one of his paintings, which had been turned into a sculpture. It was a beautiful thing. And of course, I'm going to meet Billy Connolly. And I had a couple of moments with Billy over the years, but this was first time I'd ever done a proper one-to-one with him. And so we go through to the art gallery, we get in there, and so I've set up my phone. I says, can I film? So I filmed the whole conversation on the phone, and we do the whole thing about the conversations. We get the photographs after. But again, it was that, oh God, I need that wee thing that we're not just going to talk about his paintings, and we'll do all that. So I took him back to one of my favourite things about Billy Connolly was An Audience With, that iconic ITV special that he made back in the day. And I just said to him, I says, what do you remember about that night? I says, because that changed my whole appreciation and understanding of comedy when I watched that. I remember how I howled with laughter. I says, I'm still laughing now when I watch it. You know, when we watch it all these years later, you still laugh at these routines. And he started telling me about where they all came from and how he was feeling that night, because he'd just done a tour. And he says, I didn't want to go on telly and do all my new stuff. He says, so I just thought I'd just go and do some old bits. So I was just doing some old bits, he says, and you can see me as I'm going through it. I'm kind of not sure what I'm going to be doing next. But then I find something and then I just go. And I'm just getting this goal from him. And he was utterly, utterly lovely. And he signed my book, because I got his autobiography in for my Christmas. And, and so he signed it and I got my photograph taken. So I'm like, ah.
That is life made for me. Yeah, that'd be a life made moment. What
just
a privilege.
Have that wee half hour with Billy, and then especially because we've all gone into lockdown now and you very rarely get to do a face-to-face with anyone. So he's absolutely going to be up there as one of my favourites.
What a legend. I am going to move on to our quick fire question section, Grant. Okay, so I always tell guests that these are the fundamentals on which I judge a person. So definitely feel judged, Mr. Stott. So I give you two options, and if you could just fire back with your instinctive answer.
Sure.
Okay, here goes. TV or theatre?
Theatre.
The Bard or Burns?
Burns.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Chippy sauce, come on then.
Sin or virtue?
Oh, I like a wee bit of sin now and again, don't we?
Oh. Stage left or stage right?
Oh, stage left for the villain.
Of course. Evening or matinee?
Evening.
The Stalls or the Royal Box?
The Stalls.
Quinoa or cake?
Oof, cake.
Always. Arthur Miller or Molière?
Molière.
True crime or fiction?
True crime.
Land or sea?
Land.
Warm up or fly by the seat?
Ooh, fly by the seat.
Period dance or stage fighting?
Stage fighting. Come on then.
No, you know one for the period dance? No.
Yeah, fun enough.
The Slosh or the Macarena?
Oh, the Slosh. It's a classic.
Fancy Nancy or Dress Down?
Fancy Nancy. Quite like that.
Bollinger or beer?
Beer.
And that concludes the quick fire questions.
Oh, I felt quite under pressure there.
Thank you so much, Grant, for coming on and coming armed with your best chat. I so appreciate it, and it's so lovely to see you.
Oh, thank you, Nicola. Hopefully next time it's face-to-face and we've got a wee glass of something cold in our hand to enjoy.
Absolutely, and maybe in a theatre. How nice would that
be? Fingers crossed. Let's do it. Let's get them back open and let's get back and enjoying live theatre once again. Come on.
Thanks very much, Grant. See you soon.
Take care. Thank you, Nicola. Take care.
Oh, what a great chat with Grant. I always love hearing his Edinburgh banter, and I always walk away feeling very positive after talking to him. I also reckon he really does have a potential sideline in doing the tourist ads for Edinburgh. Just putting out there, folks. Next up is one of Scotland's funniest ladies. It is TV and theatre actress, comedian and DJ, singer and star of programmes such as Chewing the Fat. It is, of course, the hilarious Karen Dunbar. You really will need some bladder control for this one, folks. Again, thank you so much for joining us. And do remember to leave that cheeky wee iTunes review. Oh, 5 stars. You're making me blush. Hit subscribe on your podcast app so you never miss an episode. And lastly, why not join the conversation with us over on Twitter at Cultural Coven and Instagram at Cultural Coven Pod. It's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. Take care and have a good week. The Cultural Coven is presented in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, co-created by me, Nicola Roy, produced by Lee Kennedy, with editing and sound engineering by Barry McCall and music by Cameron Barnes.